Want a chance to win £250 in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be £250 better off.
Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAB. Since returning to the White House in January 2025, U.S. President Donald Trump has berated European allies about their defense spending, threatened the annexation of Greenland, and seized the Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro. To talk about Donald Trump's foreign policy, in February 2026, I spoke to Walter Russell Mead. Professor Mead is the Ravenel B. Curry III, Distinguished Fellow in Strategy and Statesmanship at the Hudson Institute, the Alexander Hamilton Professor of Strategy and Statecraft with the Hamilton Center for Classical and Civic Education at the University of Florida, and the Global View columnist at the Wall Street Journal. A discussion covered Trump's highly activist foreign policy and his approach to the Western Hemisphere as a strategic foundation for American power, as well as the performative politics of his America First rhetoric. Professor Mead also puts President Trump in historical context, drawing parallels with Andrew Jackson and James Polk. We also talked about the major challenges ahead for Donald Trump, including the U.S.-China relationship and U.S. domestic politics after the 2026 midterms, and on how other countries can navigate his transactional approach. I really enjoyed our wide-ranging conversation, and I hope you do too. So thanks so much for joining us on The Ballpark today. Just to start things off, could you just briefly introduce yourself for our listeners and just talk a bit about what you're currently working on? Thank you.
My name is Walter Mead, and I write a weekly column on international relations for the Wall Street Journal. I teach at the University of Florida, and I'm a senior fellow at a Washington think tank. So I kind of keep myself busy doing a lot of different things.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So your talk at LSE today is American Foreign Policy in the Age of Trump, and looks at the consequences of Trump's second presidency on America's international relations. Could you just give our listeners a brief overview of the major U.S. foreign policy developments that have occurred since Trump returned to the White House, and maybe some of the impact this has had on the wider world?
That would be hard to do. It's one of the most consequential years, I think, that any of us can remember. And it is much too early to know what all the impacts will be or how far he's going to go in certain directions. But we really can see it is people who were worried that, or perhaps hoped or believed that Trump was an isolationist got that wrong, that Trump has been one of the most activist presidents we've had internationally, for good or for ill. Some have thought that, well, maybe he was trying to carve out an American sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere, which would leave other parts of the world for other powers. But it really doesn't look like Trump believes that anybody but him should have a sphere of influence. And he doesn't seem to see any boundaries to this sphere where he would like to have that influence. So he's an extremely ambitious agenda. How far successful he will be, who can tell? I think the current crisis in Iran will have a lot to do with how history views his success or lack of it in foreign relations. But it is definitely one of the most interesting presidencies I think any of us have seen.
Thank you. So you mentioned Iran, but are there regions of the world that have received more attention than others in Trump's foreign policy? Some of our listeners will be aware of the Venezuela actions as well. And why might that be the case?
It looks to me as if Trump is conducting his own vision of a global foreign policy, because you think about the tariffs, the international economic diplomacy that Trump has pursued. Clearly, he's fought with his allies in Asia. He's fought with his allies in Europe. So he's not confining his attention to the Western Hemisphere. He has, however, been much more forceful. You can look at Venezuela and Cuba. Those are two countries that for some time the U.S. has had difficult relations with, but where Trump has been able to kind of make his foreign policy look desirable to some of the people who voted for him. And he said, look, what are Venezuela and Cuba doing? Both of them are conducting such terrible economic policies that they're literally driving millions of their own citizens out as refugees, which creates big problems for the rest of the hemisphere. Venezuela especially, but to some degree Cuba, is in league with drug cartels. And in that way, if you have a relative who's died of a fentanyl overdose, they've played some part in that. And people would say, well, the fentanyl and so on. But he still makes that point that they are contributing to the drug problem. Then he would argue, too, that they're creating opportunities for Iran, for Russia, and China in the Western Hemisphere that undermine security. So from the Trump point of view, that's three strikes. And unlike past presidents, who I think shared a lot of that analysis as to what was wrong, Trump believes he found a way to do something about it with the abduction or the arrest of the president of Venezuela and holding their sort of oil sales up and saying, you can sell as much oil as I allow you to sell. Which means in his mind, he thinks he can control events or shape events in Venezuela without having to have boots on the ground in Venezuela, which is a very interesting concept. We don't know the end game here. So far, I would say it is probably going a little better than some of his critics expected, but we've seen just the first act of a very long play. But it is a very, very dramatic set of events. Many observers looked at this and said, wow, he's just going to do the Western Hemisphere. That's all he's going to care about. I think what the Trump people would say in answer to that is the Western Hemisphere is a foundation of American foreign policy. Past administrations neglected the erosion of American power in the Western Hemisphere. So you have to correct that if you're serious about American power. But having corrected it, having strengthened your foundation, well, then you go on to act in other places as well. I think that's how they are selling it. Again, we will all see how it comes out in the wash.
So many scholars and commentators have highlighted the principles of America First as a driving force behind Trump's domestic and foreign policies. How useful is that label in trying to understand Trump's decision-making on the world stage?
I think it's very important with Trump to realize that the source of his power in domestic politics and indeed internationally is he's found a way to turn eyeballs into political power. That is to say, by capturing the world's imagination, for good or for bad. And there are people who can't stop thinking about him because they hate him so much. And then there are others who just admire the spectacle, and then he's got real fans. But that uncanny ability to dominate the media, to dominate the mental space of the human race, no living person in the history of humanity has occupied as large a share of our species' bandwidth as Donald Trump has done. And this gives him a kind of a dominance, which we see him using very effectively in pursuit of more dominance for him, which again gives some people pause in the United States and in other places, but that's what's happening. And so a slogan like America First, we should not think that Trump speaks in order to communicate information. He speaks often in order to elicit a certain response or to influence the audience. And America First is a great slogan for him. On the one hand, a lot of people hear that slogan, they go, oh my goodness, that was Charles Lindbergh in 1940, you're an anti-Semite, oh this is just horrible. And they get all kind of bent out of shape in American politics. But Trump can then just sort of say, well, what do you want me to say? America Second? America Third? Where should America be in the priority of an American president? So he trolls his critics and opponents with that slogan while pleasing his supporters and his base. So for Trump, that's perfect. And he would just as soon have all his enemies focus on denouncing that slogan all day, all night long. He'd be happy with it.
So your talk covers and looks at the principal geopolitical arenas that Trump is engaging with and how analyzing them can help observers to decode Trump's approach to international relations. Can you talk about these specific arenas and what they can tell us about Trump's foreign policy reasoning?
Historically, American foreign policy has seen sort of several key areas for American operation. We've talked about the Western Hemisphere and Trump. There's the transatlantic relationship. And obviously here is one of the places that Trump has been extremely controversial. The talk about annexing Greenland and invading Denmark definitely did not go over well with a lot of people. Talk of conquering Canada also seems to have made, I don't know why, but it seems to have made some Canadians unhappy. So there have been these, again, extremely dramatic, compelling interventions. I was at the World Economic Forum meeting in Davos where Trump was going to give his speech. And you had, at that moment, this crowd of mostly European business leaders and political leaders and so on were fighting almost like cats and dogs. There's only so many seats in the main room. Everybody wants to be in the room where Trump is speaking because you don't know whether what you're going to hear is that NATO is dead or the liberation of Greenland proceeds as I speak to you or something else. And so Trump had them right where he wants them. Now, whether that is good for the United States long term, good for Europe long term, whatever, that we certainly can debate. But just in terms of looking at how someone in the 21st century has been able to achieve a mastery over the political and international environment, it's an extraordinary thing. And I think the issue here is that for Trump and for a lot of people kind of in his base, Europe is a good place, but a bad ally. Maybe that's the way to put it. They like European culture. They like European food. A German friend of mine says, I've now figured out how you Americans think about Europe. And I said, really, what is it? He said, you think about Europe the way we in Germany think about Italy. That is great food, wonderful people, great architecture and culture, but maybe not necessarily needing to be involved in the most serious discussions. And I don't know how many people in America that applies to, but there is a sense that for Trump and his followers that Europe has been free riding on the transatlantic alliance for years. That is, they say America is more worried about Russia taking over Europe than we are. So we can like not spend anything on defense and America will always be there to protect us. And then they want to say that protecting us is a moral duty, that for America not to let us free ride on America would be a dereliction of America's moral responsibility. You're immoral. You're a criminal if you don't let me have free defense or almost free defense. Then with the money they're saving, this would be Trump's view, they then have this big, large, expensive welfare state to make the politicians happy. And they talk about how nasty the Americans are because their welfare state isn't as generous as what the noble Europeans do, unlike those defense-minded, backward Americans. And then finally, because the Europeans have felt safe, and this is also true to some degree, the Japanese under the American umbrella, they say, fine, and now we're going to trade with Russia and we're not going to worry anything about whether our trade is building up Russia as an enemy. That's been essentially the European position. And Trump has had it, I think is a way to put it. From his point of view, Bush, Obama, Biden all asked Europe nicely to do more, and Europe responded with indifference. Only Trump has been able to get Europe, in his mind, to do even anything, to take the first steps. So, to try to understand what's going on, a rational analyst could look at the world and say, problem for the United States is that as China rises, its two main sets of allies, Japan and Korea in the Far East and the Atlantic alliances, they are basically no longer spending on defense. They've become completely kind of addicted to a free ride, which America can no longer afford to give. And they have resisted every polite entreaty ever made to change their ways. So what are you going to do about it? And it looks as if Japan is going to be increasing defense spending dramatically. It looks as if Europe is going to be increasing defense spending dramatically. Trump has managed to get the Europeans to pick up much more of the cost of the Ukraine war than certainly initially was being done. So all of these things are arguably strengthening the American alliance system, even as they create really bad feeling among some American allies. And a lot of Trump's critics will say, you know, why are you creating all this bad feelings? It's because if you don't create the bad feeling, you don't change the underlying situation, which is unsustainable. Again, will history regard this as correct? We will see. But right now, you have to say Europeans are more aware of the importance of NATO to their own security than they've been, certainly since the fall of the Berlin Wall. and they are prepared to do more on defense than they've been able to do, than they were looking at again since that time. I don't think you can quite call it a failure. You can maybe say it's a ruinous success. It costs so much in goodwill that Europe will now organize against the United States. My guess is that's probably not the way things will go, but we will see.
So you've already mentioned some previous presidents before Trump. So looking to that history, how does Trump's foreign policy square up with that of his predecessors? And in what ways is it a break from previous administrations, including his first term back in 2017? And just to add another question to that mix, if none of the other presidents were keen on pushing Europe more than politely, as you say, what's pushed to be more aggressive in his trying to get Europe to pay more for their own defense?
To understand Trump in terms of American history, I think what you have to do is not so much look at any of his post-World War II predecessors, but you go back to an earlier era. I wrote a book about 25 years ago called Special Providence that looks at four different schools or ways of thinking about American foreign policy. The kind of Hamiltonian school, which looks at sort of creating a strong economic base and in a sense, being a bit like 18th, 19th century Britain, using your trade to create an international system that keeps you rich and secure, balance of power, those kinds of things. Then there's the Wilsonian school, which sees creating a world order based on human rights and international law as the way to keep America safe. The Jeffersonian school, which is much more isolationist and says that the more the U.S. gets involved in international politics, the bigger our army has to get, the less free our government becomes because the government has to become more powerful. So we should minimize our international engagements. And then the Jacksonian school, which is kind of an aggressive nationalism. It's not interested in conquering other peoples. If there's any spare land around that is very lightly inhabited, the Jacksonians might be interested. Greenland is the kind of place. But Andrew Jackson, as president, he got rid of the central bank of the day, the Second Bank of the United States. He mobilized the U.S. fleet to attack France because it wasn't going to pay its debts from the Napoleonic era wars. He was very much in favor of annexing Texas and increasing the size of the United States and was a real populist. But the Jacksonians, and I think Trump does fit to some degree in this category, aren't interested in exporting ideas. So Woodrow Wilson talked about World War I as a war for democracy and a war to end war. Jacksonians, we see in Venezuela, Trump didn't say, okay, I'm going to put in the army to create a democracy. It's deals. Don't attack the United States. Don't endanger our security, and we'll leave you alone. But if you mess with us, then we will come in and crush you. That's more the Jacksonian thing. But you don't have to become a democracy to have a decent relationship with the United States.
So you've written extensively in the Wall Street Journal about the nature of Donald Trump's foreign policy. And in a piece last year, you argued that it was surprisingly good for the world. Could you talk about why this might be the case?
Yeah. I say surprisingly good because everybody thinks it's absolutely horrible without any redeeming features whatever. So if you point to a couple of things that are less than catastrophic, everyone says, you are a Trump loyalist. You're a Trump supporter because the discussion is so shaped and not without reason. But I do think that, as I said earlier, the fact that Europeans and Japanese are saying we have slithered into a position of utter weakness. We are technologically backward. We have ignored our defense. We've completely gotten all the big questions wrong for a generation. Okay, that's positive from the standpoint of the United States. Positive, I think, from the standpoint of the whole world. Europe and Japan were digging themselves ever deeper into a hole, and that's not good for anybody. And again, his predecessors saw that, but really weren't able to do much about it. You know, so rightly or wrongly, the Trump method achieved these results, and I think that is actually important. I think the actions in Iran of weakening that country, again, we'll see what the next steps are and where that goes. But Venezuela and Cuba actually were becoming real hellholes. and they were having a terrible effect on the neighborhood. I think China has, Xi Jinping looks at what's going on. He tried to intimidate Japan. He tried to basically force the prime minister to weaken her by launching an attack when she said in parliament that Chinese invasion of Taiwan would be a grave issue for Japan, which it certainly would be. It's kind of an obvious truth. And the Japanese response was to elect her with the largest majority of any Japanese leader since World War II. So what we're actually seeing is a revitalization of American allies, angry as they are with Trump. But in this sense, we can think of him as something of an alarm clock, a loud noise. You don't want to hear it. It's an ugly sound, but now you're awake and out of bed, and so you'll get to work on time.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win 250 pounds in vouchers.
So what major challenges does Trump face in achieving his vision of global order or his vision of America's ideal role in the world?
He faces zillions of challenges. The greatest one is clearly Xi Jinping, who has his own vision of the world. And the U.S.-China competition is something that we're only at the beginning of even trying to understand what it is. Never in history have two countries this economically interconnected found themselves in exactly this position. There are some analogies to Britain and Germany early in the 20th century, but obviously things are just much more complicated now. And the personal connections, the academic and business connections, it's really deep. And each side, I think, is still discovering and trying to figure out where does the balance of advantages lie. China plays the rare earth card and Trump plays the tariff card and people do this, people do that. Where does it all end up? Both sides have serious vulnerabilities. So in a sense, working out what is a viable path in U.S.-China relations is at the center of international politics for everybody, and we don't know how it's going to go. Trump faces huge internal problems. I think most observers would say the midterm elections are unlikely to go his way. So he may spend the second half of his term fighting, 15 impeachment resolutions for who knows what will happen. But certainly the Democrats will throw everything they've got at him. And depending on whether the Republicans are able to hold the Senate or not, he may not be able to get officials confirmed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So lots of challenges at home. I think the Supreme Court appears likely to rule his tariff policies unconstitutional. There are other authorities he can use, but not with the same kind of flexibility. That will reduce his power because a big element of Trump's power is to be able to say to any CEO or any government, I can sign my name to a piece of paper and I can either make you rich or poor depending on what I do. I can be your worst nightmare or your best friend. Which do you want me to be and how do you intend to persuade me to see things your way? That's Trump's proposition now. You take that tariff card away from him, and while he still has a lot of carrots and a lot of sticks, those were the easiest to wield. And the world resists the imposition of a single will. The world likes to move in different directions. If we go back 40 or 50 years, much of the developing world was hoping to become more like the West, more like Europe as development proceeded. And there was this sort of one model of democracy, one model of a national society. And I think in some ways, the Industrial Revolution imposes a kind of a conformity on human governance because you need certain institutions to be able to have factories and power plants and roads and all of those things. The information revolution seems to promote different ways to get there. So you see Turkey becoming more Turkish, Hindutva in India. You're seeing a lot more sort of assertion of cultural independence and desire for recognition, which doesn't mesh all that well with Donald Trump wanting to kind of bestride the world like a colossus. So he's got a whole range of problems. And I forget who it was, the British politician who says that all political careers end in failure. In the end, all any of us do is leave footprints in the sands of time. Trump clearly is leaving a deep footprint, but there will be limits to what he can accomplish.
And staying outside of the US, what would your advice be to countries in terms of how to handle Trump's style of foreign policy, and how can they accommodate it within their own relations with the US?
Well, I can't give general advice because the United States is more important to some countries than to others. You also have political leaders. Well, Prime Minister Carney in Canada sort of owes his election to anti-Trump sentiment and is going to play that organ as well as he can, as long as he can, because that's the key to Canadian politics right now. I wouldn't advise any Danish leaders to work really hard to become Trump's friend unless you want to lose your job and lose your seat in the Danish parliament. So I think probably the thing to do that everybody needs to try to understand is understand what is Trump trying to accomplish? What is the vision? And that's hard because Trump is not interested in revealing himself to you. He keeps his intentions dark. It's a real debate. Does he even have intentions, or just on the spur of a moment, does he do things? I tend to believe he does have some sort of convictions about how the world works that lead him in certain directions. But for example, for Europeans thinking about Ukraine and this, it does strike me that people don't seem to understand the kind of basis of his approach here, that it is China-centric in a way, that the United States, I think in Trump's view, actually needs a strong Russia. You want China to have to look over its shoulder every time it thinks about invading Taiwan or something. So you don't want a Carthaginian peace in Ukraine. In fact, you do want the war to end. For Trump, he cares less about where the boundary is than he cares about that it's over. But also, he doesn't want it to end as one of these frozen conflicts where there's no trade across the frontier and no investment. He actually wants to try to pull Russia, not ideologically toward the West, but geopolitically toward the West by offsetting the appeal of China and playing on Russia's very real and deep fears of China. So that kind of thinking, if you understand that, then it's easier to think, what does Trump's mental map of this situation look like? And for Europeans, this means there's a big problem that the inviolability of national frontiers can't change boundaries in war. For modern European politics, that is a fundamental thing. And that's why they'd rather have a zillion frozen conflicts than decisively say occupied Crimea for 50 years, than say, no, you're not going to get it back. And the law has to follow reality rather than define and shape reality. That's going to be a big point of conflict if Europeans want to make it that. And so thinking about how do you influence Trump, you have to think about, okay, where does what I want really hit him in the wrong way? And how bad do I want this thing? How much is it worth to me? And what are the alternatives? If I was willing to give, if I was willing to say, okay, we're going to have normal trading relations with Russia after the war, and we're going to end the war. We're not going to try to relitigate it a million times. It's going to be over. Can I get something from Trump in that case? But you try to put yourself in Trump's position. Figure out, are there things that he values more than you do that you can sell at a good price?
And for my last substantive question, as the U.S. enters its 250th anniversary year, which of his predecessors does Trump most resemble in terms of foreign policy and his view of the world and his potential effect on the future of America?
I would say probably Andrew Jackson and James Polk, who was Jackson's sort of chosen candidate in 1844. I think those are the two. He is, in his global ambition and in his willingness to disregard international law if the stakes are sufficiently high. Teddy Roosevelt had some of that. There was that great comment about the Panama Canal. His Secretary of State, I think it was, said, Mr. President, it would be such a shame if the faintest tint of legality would mar this brilliant accomplishment. He is, in a sense, you could say he's a throwback to an older era, but maybe he is the harbinger of a new one. Because I tend to think that many of us, particularly in the West, though not only in the West, badly want to draw a sharp boundary between 1945 and the rest of history. We want to say, oh, no, that was all in the past, and we don't do that anymore. We don't have to worry about that stuff anymore. It's over, okay? I don't think it is over. I think the future has all the potential for great good and great evil that it's ever had. And Trump is actually a sign, and not only Trump, but around the world, you see these figures and movements popping up, and you see the shape of a new world, much more like the pre-1945 world. I would just as soon continue living in a nice, peaceful holiday from history. That would be my preference. But I'm enough of a realist, not in the sense of an IR relations realism, but just as someone who tries not to fool themselves about what's happening in the world, to think that that hope is unreal and we had better be doing the best we can to prepare for a future that is likely to be extremely challenging and rarely dull.
Thank you. So just before we finish, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Well, besides my weekly column, I have been trying to write a series of essays. Some of them have appeared in Tablet magazine, one of them recently in The Atlantic, where I try to look at where is Trumpism coming from? Why was Trump able to break the old establishment in the Republican Party? In this article in The Atlantic, it's called The Rise of the Tech Hamiltonians, I ask, why is it that Silicon Valley, which with a couple of exceptions bitterly opposed Trump both in 2016 and 2020, why in 2024 did they emerge as such an important source of support for him? And arguably, without the tech money and the MAGA populism, he could never have been elected. So why did they flip? And what can that tell us about the future of American politics? So I think all of us need to understand that new forces, a lot of it connected to this information revolution, which is going to be as consequential and as disruptive and as frankly terrifying as the Industrial Revolution was. And the Industrial Revolution includes World War I and World War II and the rise of communism, fascism, and wars of genocidal extermination across half of Europe. Information revolution is going to be that big. Maybe it won't be that bad. Maybe we can learn something. But as that happens, all of us have to start looking at politics in a much deeper way. And that's what I'm trying to do in some of these essays.
Thank you. And our listeners can find links to all those resources in our show notes. Just remains for me to say, Professor Walter Russell Mead, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thank you.
Walter Russell Mead is a Ravenel B. Curry III Distinguished Fellow in Strategy and Statesmanship at the Hudson Institute, the Alexander Hamilton Professor of Strategy and Statecraft with the Hamilton Center for Classical and Civic Education at the University of Florida, and the Global View columnist at the Wall Street Journal. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Walter Russell Mead for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Evan Fatah. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.